So the first question I wanted to ask them is if they could talk a little bit about their research into the history of the commons, which not just our commons here in Halifax, but the idea of the commons was actually a thing that existed in medieval Europe and elsewhere. So I asked them to begin by talking a little bit about the history of the commons as an actually existing phenomenon.
First of all, I want to thank all of you, and in particular Max, but also the organizer of the Commons Conference for having brought us here. And I want to say how happy I am, you know, to arrive at Halifax at the very moment in which you are celebrating, you know, this strange social formation, which is the common. I know that it refers here to a physical space, but it actually evokes images from a whole world of relation that unfortunately is now vanishing, as Max was pointing out. You know, we now live in a world where everything is subjected to the laws of the market. And this is a very terrifying prospect. Now, personally, I came to the commons first to begin to study the history of the commons when I was researching the history of capitalism, the development of capitalism, and in particular, the history of women within capitalism. And I wanted to understand the roots of women's oppression. I wanted to understand why in capitalist society women are still discriminated against, have less social power than men. And so I began a long journey that brought me to go back to the Middle Ages, you know, to the time before the advent of capitalism. And this was my first encounter with the concept of the commons and with the reality of the commons. Because, in fact, the commons is a very technical term, if you want. It's a very specific term that refers to the lands that the peasantry in Europe, during the feudal period, in the feudal economy, you know, held in common, not as property, but as in use. This means that you had a society that was basically organized and it was basically controlled by a military class, you know, the feudal lords, and they controlled all the land, they owned all the land, you know, but the way the worker subsistence was organized, you know, unlike what you have in capitalism, where you have a wage system, was organized through the distribution of land, through the peasant, through the servants, through the serfs, and those lands were given to them to be held in common so that they could cultivate them for part of the week and they could use them for their subsistence. So the common land, these were the commons, actually included more than just land. The commons included also woods. So there'll be very specific rights, you know, and each of these rights, for example, throughout the Middle Ages, became a terrain of struggle, right? So the commons meant woods, meant ponds, where people, you know, could go and fish, take some fish for them, for themselves, or they could go to the woods and get some fuel. The so-called waste, where you could have animals graze, and of course, pasture. And in many cases, not only were these resources held in common and used, but all the activities that they generated, that they required, were also held in common. So for instance, in many, many cases, the feudal lords, whether they were barons or counts and so on, would have collective contracts. Basically, they would have a village and they would decide collectively with the whole village what had to be done. And then the commoners themselves, the serfs themselves, decided collectively when to harvest, you know, when to sow, how many animals would be in a particular place. So they actually, the sharing of the common, the sharing of the land, you know, generated a whole set of relations, generated a very intense relation of cooperation. And many decisions were taken by peasant assemblies, basically discussing together what to be done. And in fact, I believe I came to the conclusion where one of the most interesting parts of the research that I did was my discovery of the struggle of the Middle Ages, which had never been taught to me in any class in which I'd been. Every time I studied the Middle Ages, it was always a story of queens and kings and battles, but I never actually studied the everyday life of people, and I discovered that everyday life was an everyday life of struggle. And in fact, the commons were at the center of the struggle because, of course, the serf continuously struggled to extend their rights, to extend the land, to extend, you know, what they could use and what they could share. I think that the power that I saw, you know, throughout the Middle Ages, the servants had with relation to the feudal class, you know, derived precisely by the fact that they had a direct use of land and other means of subsistence, and also that that use created was on a collective basis, created a collectivity, you know, created a daily habit, practice of cooperation that was very fundamental for the type of solidarity, you know, that was required by a struggle. And I also, for example, in the case of women, I realized that, in fact, the women too, that the situation of women, the position of women, you know, in the feudal society, particularly the rule of feudal society, was stronger than the position of women would become later in capitalism. Among other things, because, you know, women always worked together in a cooperative way. Whether it was doing the wash, whether it was doing the sewing, and so on, you always have women working together as a collectivity. And of course, procreation was always the moment of procreation, the moment of delivery was always a very, very collective event. If you look at the, for example, representation of maternity, you know, the woman who gives birth, you never have the woman alone with the doctor. Right, but you always have a collectivity of women. And that was representative of, in fact, what the situation with women was in all the arc of their life, in all the arc of their activity. And, you know, there's much more to say, but I don't want to take too much time. I will only add that what I'm describing is the commons as organized, as lived, as struggled about, you know, in feudal Europe, in the Middle Ages, and you have, again, something remaining from that organization here in your city. But actually, the commons, intended in a broader sense, you know, is the way in which human beings have organized their reproduction, you know, through most of human history. You know, the Native American, the indigenous people of the Americas actually lived in commons, organized commons. The land, the woods were used collectively. They were not private property. You know, if you look at the history of Africa into the 19th century, in some parts of Africa, even into the present, you know, you had communal system of land ownership, you know, managed through customary laws, you know. And the Americas, South America, the Andes, you know, actually from Tierra del Fuego to Texas, you know, was one big commons, even during the time when you had empires, like the Aztec Empire, the Incas Empire. The bulk of the peasantry still work with communal forms of communal form of property. So it's a very, today people say the commons. What is the commons? You know, it's very important that we realize, you know, that actually private property, if you look at the history of humanity in a broad, from a broad scope, you will see that private property is more of the exception than the rule. That actually human beings have for infinite amount of years have organized themselves in a collective way. Although, of course, when we speak of commons, we don't speak of the same social formation. There are many ways in which you can organize, you know, the sharing of the goods of the earth, of the wealth of the earth. There are many ways in which you can organize them. For example, the Ailu system that prevails in the Andes, it's a different system from the system that prevailed in feudal Europe. You know, it's a whole system that has all kinds of collectively self-imposed regulation. For example, rules of reciprocity, whereby people collectively help each other, like we all organize ourselves to help Max to build this house. Yes. And then with the understanding that Max will join others and help us to build the house, et cetera, et cetera. So great rules of reciprocity, which were very, very strong also in the ethics, in the culture of the indigenous people of the Americas, who always had present in mind, as you know, because they are part of the culture of Canada and certainly Nova Scotia, that you know, you don't only take from the earth, but you have to give back. You know, the reciprocity has to be the principle of life, you know, not only among people, governing relations among people, but also governing our relationship with our ecosystem. And we want to come back to it later when we speak more about the commons.
So the next question follows up on that, which is, what happened to the commons? What was the process by which that world that you describe was transformed into the world that we find ourselves in now, where private property seems to rule over increasingly more areas of life, from not only land ownership, but also education, for instance, all these other ways of our lives that have to pass through the market?
Well, the book that I just finished writing and publishing is called In Letters of Blood and Fire. And it's actually a quotation from the work of Karl Marx, who described the beginning of capitalism and in fact points out that in order for capitalism to exist, the commons had to cease to exist. And in order for that to happen, that story was written in Letters of Blood and Fire. It was not an easy transition. It was not I win, you win relationship. It was a relationship of violence and terror. Okay, the story that Sylvia has described of the commons in Europe, the commons in Africa, the commons in the Americas in 1492, you might say, is basically a situation which was very difficult for capitalism to take off. It had to basically destroy the commons in all these areas. And how it was, and the reason why is very simple, and it's sort of logical. And the logic of history worked out in extreme violence, of course, but it was a logical process. Because in order for capitalism to exist, it needs to have workers who could be exploited, who could be whose labor can be used to gather wealth for capitalists, to make profits and to pay rents and interests and so on. So how are you going to get people to work for you? Okay. Now one thing is very clear: if a person has his or her subsistence very easily available on the basis of their work and the work of their fellows. If they are working in common, on a common property, basically it's very difficult to get them to work for somebody else in order to make that other person or that other class rich. Makes sense, doesn't it? It's only when you're very desperate you're very needy, you have nothing in your hands, that you will accept, if you can call it accept, you will accept the situation where you will work for someone else and accept the fact that you're going to be exploited and overworked because you don't have anything. Now, if you're in a common, and if you're commoning, if your ability to organize your subsistence is assured, then of course you won't do it. So one of the most important developments in order to have a capitalist society was the end of the commons, was the attack on the commons. This attack on the commons in Europe is well known, and it took place with extreme violence. And it's a story that stretches from the 15th century into the late 19th century. And if you follow it, you see that the genteel British did to their own folks what, in fact, they did to Africans and to indigenous Americans. So the story of the commons and the attack on the commons, which Marx calls primitive accumulation or original accumulation, which meant this is a process that involves the accumulation not of things, but of people, but of labor. In other words, to create the conditions under which people could be exploited required the destruction of the commons. And when we look at the story of what happens with the indigenous people, for example, the initial thing that develops with Columbus and the effort to basically take the indigenous people on the islands in the Caribbean and force them to, instead of take care of their own basic needs and agricultural processes, to go and pan for gold on the streams of their islands, was and therefore neglect what was important for them. This was like one of the first acts of primitive accumulation, and it wasn't done because the indigenous people wanted it, but they were under the gun. And so these letters of blood and fire occurred all over the planet, and in a way, this is a story that is very important for us to understand, because the system is always attempting to present itself as really the paragon of rationality, of consent, of freedom. And in fact, if we examine, often that's what happens when you go back to the past, right? Open the books and say, let's see where did the money come from? And it came from the labor of people who have been violently expropriated. And so that's the story of the origin of capitalism and its relationship to the commons. And it's been a very important for us to understand that it's not only a story of the past, but also of the present, and I fear the future.
Unless we stop it. Yes.
I wanted to, before moving on to the next question, I wanted to bring up, we were talking about this the other day. I've been reading George and Sylvia's work for many years, and it helped me understand something about the history of this province and this city. As many of you know, because of recent controversies, the city's founder, Cornwallis, is a figure of great infamy because of the bounty that he placed on Mi'kmaq scalps, where he had mercenaries and his own military men hunt down Mi'kmaq men, women, and children to extirpate them from the country, to allow for the establishment of this fortress. But interestingly, Cornwallis learned those skills along with other generals and military men, including Monckton, after whom the town is named, Geoffrey Amherst, after whom the town is named, Wolfe, the great hero of the Plains of Abraham. All of these famous figures learned these skills when they were inflicting clearances and enclosures and destroying the commons in Highland Scotland, where their men cleared huge swaths of land of populations. And it's no accident that this happened, and that then those Highland Scots who had been dispossessed of their land, their clan system had been destroyed, became the cannon fodder for colonization of Nova Scotia, or Mi'kma'ki, or Acadie, depending on who names it. These were the settlers who were brought over, often as indentured servants, in order to settle the land and seize it from its former inhabitants. So there's a cycle that we see of these overlapping waves of enclosure of the commons, the way that this land was enclosed as private property for Anglophone settlers. And of course, we know the violence that occurred here on these lands. We know the violence of Cornwallis. We know by his own hand that Amherst signed the papers that authorized the use of smallpox blankets to be used as biological warfare against the Mi'kmaq people during the Seven Years' War, or as it's known in the United States, the French and Indian War. So there's a way that these things travel, and that the process of, as George mentions and Sylvia mentions, the process of enclosure and the destruction of the commons of Europe is tied in with the destruction of the commons and the enclosure of land and the colonization and genocidal colonization policies here. Both of you, in addition to having written quite a lot of incredible work on the history of the commons, have also been at the forefront of explaining why we should use the concept of the commons today as a metaphor and as an actuality to describe the contexts of our struggles, whether they're for water, whether they're for land, whether they're for community. Can you speak a little about that?
Yeah, I think that the concept that actually is not only us, but the return of the idea of the commons, you know, in radical politics. It's something that has taken place all through, you know, starting from the 80s, the 90s, up to today, you know, all throughout the world. It's, you know, wherever I turn today, either traveling or reading, I find that discussion is really very much concerned with this question. And I think it has to do for a number of reasons. It's really a response to, first of all, the neoliberal program, you know, the process of globalization that, as we said before, you know, is now, you know, pushing people to an edge. As George was pointing out, I mean, primitive accumulation has been almost a permanent process. It's not something that was confined to the past, but has continued to reoccur, and today it's achieving a brutality and an extension that is almost unprecedented. It's a globe-wide phenomenon. And everywhere you have privatization of land, privatization of every type of resource, you know, also privatization of areas of social life that at one point we treated as sort of commons. You know, for example, public healthcare, you know, public education, you know, publicly administered pensions. These, in a sense, we have come to look at them, to look at these benefits as something that was part of our common, of our entitlement. And we are now, everything we see from the land to the forest to the healthcare services, they are now becoming, they are vanishing, you know, from our horizon. So we are basically approaching a world where soon we will not be able to have access without paying, you know, to any piece of land, to, you know, to any wood, to any beach, to any coastal area, or to any form of entitlement, whether it is, I said, healthcare or transport or education. This is a reality that now is becoming very, very close to us. So I think that the idea of the common, you know, has come back to us as a response, as a reaction, you know, against this, you know, surge of privatization. There's also been the example of the struggle of indigenous people. I mean, the struggle of indigenous people has really climaxed from the, through the, I mean, has always been there, but certainly since the early 90s to today, as in fact more and more come to the foreground and presented us with the world, presented us with another trajectory, another historical trajectory, not only reminding us of what has happened in the past, you know, but also reminding us that there is a large part of the world in which people, large population in the world, who have not ever accepted the logic of capitalist development. They have never accepted the idea, you know, that this earth and all there is in it, you know, can be chopped up and sold, you know, as a commodity. And, you know, the experience of the struggle of indigenous people, I think, has been a very, very powerful element, you know, in bringing back the discourse on the common. For example, in the United States, I know for sure that many people, many activists, many in the 90s went to travel to Chiapas, the example of the Zapatistas. You know, the Zapatista movement emerged in response to the privatization of land in Mexico, to the abolition of the ejido system, you know, in Mexico in 1994. And many people who traveled to Mexico, you know, participated in the encuentros of the Zapatistas, were very much inspired, you know, by the lesson that in fact came from them as well as other indigenous communities. So I think that these are reasons why. And also there is a further factor, which I think is extremely important, is that, you know, the global restructuring of the economy has not only affected our economic resources, has not only impoverished us, but has also disintegrated so many communities. You know, the fact that jobs, industries have been relocated, you know, entire industries or forms of employment have been shut down, as meant, and of course the continuous rise in the price of housing has meant that many communities that, you know, where forms of mutual aid, you know, were there, were taken for granted, now do not exist any longer. And we find ourselves more and more in cities where we are all alien, where we don't know who is around us, you know, where those, again, forms ability to rely on other people. You know, for example, I see this particularly with the elderly. You know, today, if you are an elderly person, not very self-sufficient, and it's a big, big struggle to be able to remain in your home because all the services have been cut. And you are not part any longer of a community where there are people who may come by and say, hey, I'm going to the market, you know, do you need something? I'm going to buy a newspaper, you know, or come by to play cards for the, you know, all of that, it's gone. And so it's a response, it's a need to, in fact, begin to recreate, reconstruct a certain social fabric. That it's the precondition even to begin to resist the broader processes of privatization and also begin to reclaim, you know, that wealth that now is in the hands of the state. Which, so this is definitely, I think, the set of reasons that are at the origin of this new concern with the commons.
You might also say that it's only, I think was that the famous Joni Mitchell anthem, you only remember what you got and when it's lost?
When it's gone. Yes.
When it's gone? I think that we are in, let me just give you an example. I worked in Nigeria as a university teacher for 5 years in the 1980s, and Sylvia was also there for 3 years, and one of the things that we discovered was that the large percentage of land in Nigeria was actually farmed communally. There was communal land tenure in large areas of Nigeria, including the areas where Sylvia was teaching in the Niger Delta, which at one time was considered one of the richest areas of the planet from the point of view of both agriculture, because the soils of Africa, two different parts of Africa, went into the Niger Delta. And then also it was one of the place of tremendous fisheries. Now, this land was organized in a collective way, in a commons manner. Now, what happens is that the Nigerian government, and with the help of Exxon and Shell and the other major oil companies, took over the delta, passed laws that basically made the land, instead of the land, common land, land of the state, and began a process of moving people off, or of poisoning basically their land, to transform the delta into an oil, to siphon off the oil from the subterranean regions. So there was a struggle that we were seeing in front of our eyes, basically, of the enclosures of the primitive accumulation of letters. The letters of blood and fire were very much there. Hundreds of villages were destroyed. I mean, it's terrifying, because not only did it happen, but almost no one remembers it anymore, and it was very difficult to get that story out. And so I don't know where other hundreds of villages, thousands of villages across the planet are being destroyed in order for the process of enclosure, the destruction of common lands, to go on. And it was really when we came back from Nigeria that we began to think about the big struggles on our planet as not only being the struggles around wages, and which is of course very important, and working conditions and so on, but also increasingly the struggle is the struggle over basically the commons, and the attack on the commons, which is increasingly becoming more and more sophisticated and more clever, because as you're beginning to see, there are all sorts of devices that are being used to not only have the letters of blood and fire write the story of capitalism, but also clever devices that trick you out of.
Although the violence is always there, and in fact, always increasing in scope.
Thanks, guys. A common struggle that is going on right now, about 4 hours north of us, presently in Rexton, New Brunswick, where the provincial government there has given the green light to SWN Resources, a Texas-based corporation, to engage in the first step of a hydraulic fracturing, which is known to be an extremely ecologically destructive process for extracting natural gas from shale bedrock. And in response to this, what they perceive to be an attack on the common good, the Mi'kmaq community of El Sepuktuk, their Maliseet allies, as well as allies from the Acadian and Anglophone communities from around Atlantic Canada, have converged, and presently there is a standoff occurring outside of a compound. The protesters are holding, are refusing to allow SWN's specialized exploration trucks from leaving the compound. I understand that tomorrow or the next day there'll be a meeting between protesters and the provincial government. But very much the language that has been emerging from El Sepuktuk and the struggle there, which has brought together an unprecedented historical alliance of Acadian, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Anglophone demonstrators, is that the water is our commons, and that hydraulic fracturing threatens to destroy this common, and they refuse to call it a resource. They call it this common patrimony, or this commons. That is shared by all of these communities, and its potential destruction by this process threatens future generations. So not only there do we see an amazing act of community resilience, we also see the commons coming to the fore as an idea that can bring communities together and also help us envision a different world, because out of this protest there are discussions happening about what would the alternatives look like. How could we organize our communal lands, our common interests together, outside of this new kleptocratic regime of government and industry, where all that this region has to hope for is yet another sweetheart deal with an industry from away that might come and save us from our own poverty and destitution.